It's easy to say, rather glibly, that as an autocrat, Putin doesn't really have to think about politics in a mass sense. Well, I would actually argue that perhaps the opposite is the case. So what I want to do today is look at Putin the politician. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Now, what sparked this thinking for me was the recent news that following the Supreme Court's decision to outlaw the frankly, entirely fictional, global LGBT movement, that the police raided three or four prominent gay nightclubs in Moscow. Now, this struck me as particularly depressing news, not simply because of the actual facts in hand, but precisely because Russia, for all its protestations of social conservatism and traditionalism, actually is continuing to move in a modernizing direction. And, you know, for years now, arguably decades, Russia has had, certainly in its major cities, a fairly thriving gay scene and the like. And so this sounded like a particularly depressing case in which rhetoric, which is often, frankly, quite empty, seemed to be being played out on the ground. Now, what was particularly interesting, though, it subsequently emerged that these stories were frankly exaggerated, that it seems to be there was just one particular gay club which was raided, and media accounts built it up into something more. Now that's interesting because in some ways, if one looks at which media outlets were doing that, you know, in some cases it was ones that were clearly critical of the government, but also it was ones that don't have that kind of an agenda. It was almost as if the government itself was trying to play this up, not actually carry out the beginnings of a sort of anti-gay pogrom or similar, but happy to actually convey the image, the illusion that it was. And we've often seen this in Russian politics, to a degree in Soviet, but especially in post-Soviet times, that precisely the state's bark is not only worse than its bite, but deliberately meant to be deceptive, that you're listening to the bark and assuming that there are bites behind it. Okay, maybe that metaphor is beginning to be overextended. But either way, it got me thinking about the degree to which, at a time when, frankly, Putin seems to be abdicating responsibility over so much of whether it's military policy or economic policy and so forth, what is going on about politics? Because absolutely, Putin is interested in politics. Putin has to be. There is this, as I said, glib assumption that if you're an autocrat, you don't really have to care what the masses think. In some ways, ironically, I would suggest that absolutely the opposite is true. Think about it. If you are a democratic politician and you rise to become head of state, and then you lose the elections and you are tossed out, you probably don't have too bad a life to look forward to. There will be, if that's your particular interest, the honorifics, a position in the House of Lords if you're in the UK, chancellorship of a university, heads of prestigious foundations and the like. If you're interested in rather more mercenary goals, there will be the directorships of a dozen different corporations that are busy despoiling the world or producing weapons or whatever else. If it's ego, you can write your memoirs and in the process essentially rewrite your entire history. You can go on the international talk circuit earning huge amounts of money. Who knows, you can even become foreign secretary. Yes, I have a bit of a bee in my bonnet about the fact that David Cameron has now, as Lord Cameron, become British Foreign Secretary. A foreign policy that seemed to have been heavily based around angering Russia and appeasing China. How's that looking now? Anyway, to move on. So, basically, Yes, it's a blow, but nonetheless, it's a blow from which you will certainly survive and quite possibly thrive. Not necessarily true of autocratic leaders. In the worst case, yes, they can end up dead. Even if they're not, they will forever be considered, you know, potentially a problem. Unless they are totally sort of incapable of mounting any kind of future threat, take a bow, Boris Yeltsin. Otherwise, you know, you will constantly be regarded as someone who needs to be watched, controlled and maintained. There is this story that apparently Putin obsessively watched over and over again, footage of the death of Colonel Gaddafi. I'm not actually convinced that that is true. I think that's one of these urban myths that sort of arise and then get constantly repeated, A, because they're good copy, and B, because there is no fact to actually replace the story. But still, he must be aware precisely of the fate of a whole variety of recent autocrats, whether we're talking about Ceausescu, Gaddafi, or whoever. And there is also the fact that this is a man who has seen two authoritarian regimes collapse around him, East Germany and the Soviet Union. I know I kind of hype that a lot, but I really do think that particularly the Dresden situation, I do think that was one of Putin's genuinely formative experiences. So, you know, he knows actually how fragile even apparently strong authoritarian regimes can be. And missteps by the leaders in charge or whatever else can very quickly bring the whole thing crashing down. So it really matters. And this is one of the reasons why the presidential administration, the Kremlin as a whole, is a very assiduous poller of Russian opinions, that the one of the three briefing books that Putin gets every morning, there's the FSB's one about the situation in the country from a security perspective, there's the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service's one about what's going on in the world, and there is the FSO, the Federal Protection Service's one about essentially what's going on within the elite. So if you think about it, two of the three books, briefing books he reads every day are actually precisely about domestic politics on a mass as well as elite level. So, obviously, politics matters. It matters to how he controls the country. And we're looking at the presidential elections coming up next year. Probably we'll soon have Putin sort of formally launching his candidacy. But in some ways, it's not actually about the elections. I mean, yes, of course, they're tremendously important in terms of what they show, in some ways, even in their rigged form, a measure of the regime's legitimacy and success. But actually, one could argue that they are the culmination of a process. Then in some ways, the whole point is to try and create the situation in the in-between election period, such that you don't have to do too much rigging and vote-buying and so forth actually at the elections. So politics is all around Putin. And pretty much everything he does is going to be viewed through this perspective. And when I talk about politics and Putin, I should stress that we're not just talking about Putin himself. It's people like Sergei Kiryenko, the deputy head of the presidential administration, and really the domestic political wrangler in chief. There's all the political technologists within the presidential administration. And there's also a whole sort of halo of think tanks and marketing organizations and the like that are constantly being drawn on to support the government's own political planning and the like. This is also in the context of a regime which, in my opinion, is not an ideological regime. You know, there's been this debate as to how far one can see an ideology, whether it's in Putinism as a whole or late Putinism now. I am still unconvinced. Yes, of course, there are certain themes and common patterns. There is stuff. But I'm not quite sure if when you bring all this stuff together, it actually forms an ideology, not least because an ideology has to have some kind of intellectual coherence that really I think is often lacking, even though there are many who seek to create that kind of coherent philosophical underpinning for what's happening. And in any case, this is certainly not an idiocracy, in other words, a state in which the ideology is dominant. I mean, one could argue whether or not the Soviet Union was one, whether or not Marxism-Leninism really drove policy. But certainly, even there, it was so much more explicit than whether it's Putinism, Petrushevism, or Petrushev Mishustinism, or whatever else we can call it. So, you know, I don't think it's ideology. And I think in some ways that's Putin's advantage and his problem. It's his advantage because it means that he gets to constantly chop and change, mix and match, put together policies and the theoretical underpinnings of policies that match the needs of the moment and tomorrow, without being constrained by someone saying, well, no, that's actually not part of how we formulated it back in 2014 or whatever else. So what are, I think, the emerging contours of the kind of political offer that Putin is presenting to the Russian people? And look, the first one, and this is very much illustrated by this whole rather ridiculous LGBT crackdown, is clearly social conservatism. Now, when we first saw this happening, part of me was wondering, and it is still theoretically possible, but I think very, very unlikely, whether or not actually this was being set up precisely as an opportunity for Putin to be the good czar, for there to be a certain amount of outrage and thundering against all these quote-unquote deviants, and maybe some raids and such like. And then for Putin to say, look, of course, you know, it's not natural, not right, but if people want to do that, we shouldn't get in their way. Because in fairness, Putin actually has presided to a large extent, if you take away the rhetoric and look at what's happened on the ground, to a pretty socially liberal regime in its own senses. And sometimes precisely things were set up to allow Putin to sort of to step in and basically demonstrate both his security and his confidence, but also the fact that he's actually can be more liberal than people within his own system. As I said, that was a part of an old model of Putinism. I think it's very unlikely to be happening now. Instead, well, what is going on? I mean, what is the great furore? It's not actually, in my opinion, that Russia is monstrously homophobic or the like. And I may well not be using some of the most current jargon for what we're talking about, but you'll just have to forgive me on that one, I hope. You know, actually, yes, there is a considerable societal, I don't know what you'd say, dislike, prejudice, call it what you will. But to me, it's much more like what you'd frankly encounter in Britain in the 70s or 80s. A lot of unpleasant humour and jokes and crass assumptions about what gay people are like and so forth, but not a really burning contempt or a real desire to see them rounded up and re-educated or the like. Interestingly, in this case, a Kremlin which often actually has been slightly ahead, shall we say, of social values, in this case seems to be sort of trying to reformat itself to a much, much more conservative area. In some ways, it actually would be pulling Russian society back. So what really is going on in this case? Well, let's put it into a context of a whole variety of measures currently being proposed, like the Interior Ministry, for example, with this draft law being proposed, deeply bizarre, that essentially says that foreigners coming to Russia have to essentially sign this loyalty agreement, whereby they pledge themselves not to criticise or undermine Russian values and the like. Now, look, this would probably, if it actually happens at all, which is quite questionable still, but if it happened at all, it would be, I think, very much a kind of token gesture. It would be a little bit like, I remember travelling to the United States and you'd have to fill in these boarding cards, and on the back there would be things where you have to sort of, yes, confirm that you know, are not a member of the Nazi Party, are not coming to America for the purpose of committing bigamy, are not a terrorist. And, look, I can't help but wonder how many terrorists actually get caught out. You know, I was coming to the great Satan to commit an attack of jihad, but curse you with your subtle form, I'm now having to tick the yes, I am a terrorist. You know, there is an element of that which is obviously bureaucratic. There is an element of that which is actually symbolic. These are the things that we think regard as bad. And there is presumably also an element of that that was practical. So that if, for example, you did end up doing something which you had said you were not going to do, or, you know, turned out that you had been a member of the Nazi Party or whatever, then in a way they could get you just simply on the fact that you had officially lied on a form. So, you know, different reasons. But not because they genuinely thought that actually, you know, world Nazism was going to be stamped out by this particular little tick box. So I think actually, you know, the Interior Ministry thing is quite, like the LGBT stuff, performative. It's not actually about bringing out specific effects on the ground. It's not actually as if there are lots of foreigners coming to Russia at the moment, especially in the current circumstances, who are coming in order to carry out subversive acts. And if there were, they can still be arrested, deported, or whatever else under existing laws. It's more that this is just simply a way of saying, these are things that matter to us. And I think that's the point. In the wider context, what we're seeing is a Kremlin, you might say, trying to focus on the notion of creating a war-fighting state rather than actually focusing on the war itself. And I'll come onto that in a little bit more depth in a moment. So in other words, this idea of creating this unified, martial, committed nation that together is trying to build something, and build something that is necessarily either defined in opposition to decadent Western values, or is constantly under threat from said decadent Westerners. So in some ways, it's building the notion of a beleaguered fortress, this sort of classic trope of the Putin regime, into its social policy. And yes, in the process, it hopes to essentially find itself a new support base. Why do I say a new support base? Well, the interesting thing is, if one looks at, you know, the people who, and I don't mean supported Putin in terms of turning out for the elections, but in terms of supporting it actively in the sense of being that the next generation of officials, the people who are in, you know, more enthusiastic and such like, if one looks at the youngsters, and there's a lot of mythology about old Russians versus young Russians. You know, the idea that young Russians are all for freedom and take the war and everything else, whereas older Russians, they're more pro-Putin and such like. There's some truth in that, but it conceals the fact that there is a substantial body of young Russians who are actually quite passionate supporters of Putin, supporters of the war and so forth, and have a lot more energy than the 50-something, 60-something, the 70-something-year-old supporters of the regime. And these, I think, are the people who are particularly being targeted. That sense of not just that there is a grand cause, but that there is a grand cause that actually runs counter to the mainstream of your age cohort. It's basically saying you are different, you are special, you are connecting with something that is actually domestic and rooted in your culture, your faith and such like, rather than they who are just simply seduced by shiny but ultimately tawdry and culturally meaningless foreign values. So as I said, I think it is about trying to actually create that new body of young Putinists who are actually going to drive this nation forward. Now, obviously, though, there are very significant risks. I mean, the first one is precisely that in the process, you obviously cut yourself off from certain constituencies, but that's no big deal. But more to the point, you set yourself up for all kinds of disappointments and resentments when you fail to live up to your rhetoric. Classic example, actually, is in the recent announcement that the military is going to be expanded by 170,000 people. Now, that's very easy to just simply issue as a decree, but we're actually finding that the military is really having to work very, very hard to get volunteers, recruits in for the war. They're managing it up to a certain degree, though almost certainly substantially fewer than the numbers that they're claiming, because at the moment, essentially, Putin isn't willing to see any more mobilisation of reservists on a sort of mass formal level before the elections, knowing how unpopular it is. But the point is, he has set himself a target, and this is a target which is going to be very, very hard to actually accomplish, and therefore in due course will allow people to basically have a benchmark, a measure of the system's success. We've already seen that with the police. Remember, back in December of 2022, Putin decreed a steady expansion in the overall size of the police force. It would go up to 922,000 in this year, then 934,000 next year, 938,000 in the year after. Now, that's all very well, but the point is the police themselves are actually continuing to experience a shrinkage of their establishment strength. Sorry, not of their establishment strength, their actual strength. So they have these positions in theory, but they can't find people to join. And in part, that's because at the moment, the military is offering a lot more to often what are quite similar cohorts of potential applicants, because the police career is, frankly, not very well regarded in all kinds of different reasons. But the point is this, exactly, that essentially, but once you start to have specific targets, once you start to say, we are going to do X, people will have a chance to say, in due course, you're not doing X. Obviously, from Putin's point of view, who really cares what happens after the election? It's about creating the appearance of movement, of direction. But in due course, that will come back to bite him. The second, I think, sort of risk is that even if Putin doesn't really care about all this stuff that much, and there's no evidence that he really does, you know, after all, there are openly gay people within his administration and within the presidential administration. But nonetheless, people will. People will see this. Either they will genuinely just buy the propaganda, or they will see this, and this is much more of an issue, as their opportunity. You know, we've seen this in the past when some, you know, often rather empty rhetoric from the Kremlin actually then inspires some sort of bizarre and extreme actions by local officials who think they've been given a signal and think this is the way that they're actually going to get the attention of that. I mean, for example, one could see this in the FSB. You know, it's well known, it has been for years, that the St. Petersburg and Yekaterinburg FSB offices are particularly hard-nosed, especially when it comes, and this is something that really we saw in Yekaterinburg in particular, when it comes to cracking down on foreigners, foreign students and the like, who might not be absolutely observing every single detail of their visas and the like, you know, people who might come in on a tourist visa but instead also do a little bit of work in an archive. The sort of thing which in the main gets, or certainly used to, be entirely accepted and ignored. But in someone like Yekaterinburg, much more likely to have someone, you know, some poor student being pulled out of an archive and deported. Now, it's not that there was a particular threat in either of those cities. It was precisely that it's clear that the locals thought, well, this is what we're meant to be doing, then let's show that we are that much more committed to the Kremlin's line. Surely this will get us brownie points, maybe even get us the much prized move to Moscow, where the real opportunities for enrichment, and I'm not talking about salaries, are to be found. Likewise, if one looks recently at the anti-Semitic riots in Makhachkala that I covered in a previous podcast, part of that was precisely that you have local authorities who are trying to basically find some kind of balance between what Moscow is telling them to do and what the practicalities of running these impoverished, turbulent Islamic republics in the south are, and often actually sort of went too far and, for example, thought that the emphasis on keeping the local region stable meant that they had carte blanche to basically ignore all kinds of deeply dangerous sort of festering attitudes that were there, and created the environment in which precisely it became difficult to stop this kind of local pogroms. So again, the danger is that people basically take you too seriously. They don't realise that you're actually, you know, essentially trying to calibrate how far your rhetoric will have an impact, and basically think you really mean what you say. And the final element is also that the more that you try to create some kind of a coherent, socially conservative model for the country and push it out through the media, through the laws and so forth, inevitably that means that you'll exclude people. What I find particularly is the degree to which clearly the Russian Orthodox Church, which, you know, is now essentially the Ministry of God,
has essentially driven a lot of the policies, whether it's in terms of abortion, whether it's in terms of precisely sexual orientation and the like. Now, that makes sense on one level, because after all, the Russian Orthodox Church is both willing to be a supine supporter of the regime, but also, you know, clearly has strong, deep cultural connections through society, but not throughout society. I mean, in practice, about 60% of the population of the Russian Federation is practicing Russian Orthodox. Okay, fine, 60%, a majority. But that means there's 40% who are not, who are potentially excluded by this. And very specifically, there is at least 9%. And I say at least because this is one community where there probably is a certain degree of undercounting, not least because of illegal migration from Central Asia. But anyway, at least 9% who regard themselves as practicing Muslims. And it's not just that. They are obviously disproportionately represented in, for example, turbulent regions like the North Caucasus, but also within your armed forces, because the birth rates within the Muslim republics are that much greater than the birth rates within the essentially Slavic ones. So, you know, if you're looking at, for example, you know, 18-year-olds, in other words, the age who are just about to enter their period of national service, then, again, it skews disproportionately to people who come from Muslim cultural backgrounds, whether or not they actually are religiously Muslim or not. Likewise, if you look at the soldiers on the ground, because they were disproportionately recruited from territories which were poor, because that's where a military career looked more appealing, well, again, they're more likely to come from Dagestan, from Ingushetia, from Bashkiria. You know, these are, again, areas with heavy skewing towards Muslim religion and cultural background. So you are, at the same time as you're trying to kind of create this unifying national myth around Russian Orthodoxy, you are, by definition, running the risk, and only a risk, of excluding the people who are disproportionately represented amongst the people who carry guns. So these are the risks. As soon as you start to come off the fence, as soon as you start to create this coherent vision of what a nation is, which Putin has avoided doing, fascinatingly, you know, he's happy to plunder history, but nonetheless, he doesn't try and create this sense of this is what our culture is in much more kind of granular, how it affects your day-to-day life terms up to now. Well, now he's clearly having to do it. And that may gain more traction on a large proportion of Russian population, but it also risks excluding others. And the next point I just wanted to talk about is just briefly before we have a break. I touched on this business of a war-fighting state, but not a state at war. I mean, I think this is the interesting thing, that it is clear that although Russia is involved in a large, nasty war, and one that is likely to go on for, well, to be honest, I can't see it ending in 2024. Now, quite how long beyond that, who knows? But nonetheless, let's be honest about this. I think, frankly, the Russians are appreciating it. So, you know, Russia will be at war during the elections and will continue to be at war. And yet clearly Putin does not want to make that a central element of his political platform as such. There was, and I tweeted about this, a rather, let's say, mischievous and snarky article in Moskovsky Komsomolets, the tabloid, about an interview that former, very briefly, British Prime Minister Liz Truss gave to the Wall Street Journal. And it was very much poking fun at her, poking fun at the brevity of her reign, about her calls for a much more muscular American policy, and also her geographic uncertainties when she once thought that Voronezh, the city of Voronezh, was part of Ukraine rather than part of Russia. But, you know, after all the snarkiness, I have to say sometimes entertaining snarkiness, what was interesting was, I mean, actually towards the end, it made it clear what really are the kind of ways in which Russia will be trying, Russia, the Kremlin, will be trying to spin this war. Not being about Ukraine, but being about the West as a whole. Emphasising that the West is, you might say, on one level a giant, clearly, because of the, you know, size, GDP and everything else. but a giant that really is unable to use its strength because it is too woke, it is too divided, it is too decadent. And in fact, the West has really already lost against Russia. It just doesn't know it yet. Now, the corollary of that is precisely to try and tell Russians the real war is not the shooting war in Ukraine. It is precisely a cultural and political one with an essentially hostile West that would seem on the surface to have all the high cards, but in fact is mortally weakened so long as we cleave to, you know, our cultural values, our nationhood, so long as we are united, in other words, yes, so long as everyone does what they're told. And in this context, this is why we need to be a war-fighting culture. Because without that, we are divided. And so it's actually bringing some kind of cultural dimension to this point that Putin has made time and time again, which is when Russia is divided, then Russia is vulnerable. All of this, though, while trying as little as possible to actually talk about the war itself. I mean, it's a difficult conundrum. How do you build a war-fighting state and then fight an election on the need to have military discipline without actually admitting the fact that you're in the war? We're going to see a lot more of these kind of twists and turns as Russia's propagandists try to actually sort of square that particularly difficult circle. But I think that's what we can anticipate politically. Let me just take a break and then talk about actually, on a more positive level, you know, how does Putin try and convince Russians that the future is getting better, comrades? The future is getting brighter.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
So, to continue, and by the way, my apologies if my voice is still rather croaky as I continue. Anyway, I think the main element of Putin's political strategy is, as I said, not just to talk down the fact of the war itself, but to continue to present Russia as what we could think of as a normal country. And again, it's quite interesting, I've seen that phrase crop up more in the Russian media of late. Again, I mean, how far that's because of one of the infamous Tyomniki, which are these sort of secret directives that are issued to the major media outlets on a weekly basis from the Kremlin, encouraging them about, well, what lines they ought to be taking, how they ought to be covering certain main stories, which issues they really should be highlighting, and that kind of thing. And part of that is often exactly about language, particular phrasings that need to be adopted. So, you know, when one does see across a variety of different media outlets similar-ish phrases beginning to crop up, one instantly has a tendency to suspect that there is a hand of the presidential administration's press department there. Anyway, so yes, this notion of Russia as a normal country. Of course, what does it mean? Now, the interesting thing is there's actually two dimensions to that notion. Normal in the sense of war, repression and so forth. No, nothing to see here, move along. But also normal in the sense of what a country ought to be like. Again, as juxtaposed to the sort of decadent and decaying and declining West. And there's a whole massive effort to try and, you know, stir people up with this idea that this is precisely where Russia is going. And it's also, I think, a key element you'll see within the attempts at creating the pageantry of state building. There's the current, for example, festival imaginatively called Russia at the VDNH, the National Economic Achievements Exhibition sort of showground in Moscow, which is going to run until April, conveniently enough. In other words, just after the presidential elections, which again tries to kind of bring everything together, Russian history, Russian regions, Russian culture, and basically say just how fab it really is. But also precisely to emphasize the degree to which this is not a country which, despite the fact that it has faced many emergencies, is currently in emergency mode. There's going to be a World Youth Festival as well. I will be interested to see just where the world youth eventually come from. But anyway, there's going to be a lot of this stuff in the run-up to the election. And in part, that's because Sergei Kiryenko, whom I mentioned, likes this kind of stuff. And were I a cynic, I would also suspect that they are wonderful opportunities for strategic embezzlement on the part of some people. But beyond that, again, it's also this attempt to try and find some kind of way of reconciling deeply unusual times with reassurance. And I think part of it is precisely to say, look, Russia has often been in what seem to be terrible crisis moments. We always come through. We always survive. We always thrive therefrom. So just relax. Do what you need to do today and not worry about tomorrow. Because tomorrow is crucial. Look, politics is often about trying to basically find the right sweet spot between hope and fear. Fear or the other guy. If you vote for the other guy, you're going to be, you know, mugged in your home, and the country is going to fall into economic collapse, and migrants will swarm across your border, or whatever the particular panic, moral panic of the moment is. Whereas me, vote for me, and we can all live the dream. And absolutely, tomorrow, next week, next year, your children's lives, all of those will get steadily better. I mean, that's the standard stock in trade, frankly, of political communication. Now, the thing about what's going on at the moment is, in some ways, the fear, you know, although obviously there are attempts to redirect it towards, you know, foreign subversion and those nasty LGBT people and all other things. But nonetheless, you know, essentially the fear is there. And the fear is actually of what? It's of the war, of the fact that your menfolk may well be dragged off to go and have to fight in a muddy trench somewhere. But also a fear of immiseration. Remember, you know, many Russians do have memories of really, really hard times, whether it was the 1990s or whether periods of ruble crashes since then, 2008 and such like. And the fact that a majority of Russians, when polled, actually think that the economy is going to get worse. I mean, that is not just, I will have less discretionary spending money. I mean, these are people for whom you know, this raises the prospects of serious immiseration. So there is a lot of fear already there, latently within society, in my opinion. So the attempt is to redirect that fear, but also to provide reassurance, to provide hope. And it's quite difficult at the moment to provide hope in practical terms. When you have, you know, a state budget that is 30% directed towards the military, when you have, as a corollary of that, less money being spent in real terms on, for example, the subsidies that go to the regions, and some regional leaders actually already being told that, essentially, if they don't manage to cut their spending and balance their budgets, then they will be held responsible. You know, it is clear that people know that things are going to be harder. So you have to find other ways of providing hope. And part of that is with shininess. It is with the fact that, yes, there is still, you know, despite the cuts, there is still going to be money for, you know, pretty street decorations before New Year and such like. But also precisely that notion that essentially Russia has always managed to continue to be a normal country, despite everything that it faces. But the issue is, of course, to try and encourage what the sociologist Denis Volkov, for an interesting piece for the Carnegie Endowment, which again, as usual, I'll leave a link in the programme notes, called Learned Indifference. In other words, you're telling Russians not just that there's nothing they can do about things, really. Protesting is dangerous and useless. The political process is thoroughly sort of engineered. don't really think that you have any kind of traction on what happens. So, you know, you might as well just simply sit back and take whatever is sent your way. Well, that is important. That is a really important way of controlling the country as a whole. But at the moment, Putin needs more. Putin needs actually enough people to be positive, to be active. You know, whether it's in terms of willing to sign up as volunteers for the fight, or whether it's actually to be engaged by the political message that he's selling. You know, he needs more than that. He needs to do more than just neutralize people. His system has been really good at politically neutralizing people. It's proving not so good at mobilizing people in the political rather than military sense, but also, frankly, in the military sense. So he offers this vision of a Russia which has always endured. And in that context, I thought it was really fascinating that there was an article in state newspaper Российская Газета, in which the correspondent went to Lugansk, one of the sort of cradle cities of the Russian Spring of 2014, the local sort of kind of... I always get in trouble with a certain fraction of my listeners when I say that what happened in Donbass in 2014 was anything other than just straightforward Russian intervention. Yes, there was a Russian intervention, which then come summer became, you know, total and overt. But, you know, actually the roots of the Russian Spring, it was this weird mix of intrusion by the Russian state, intrusion by all sorts of ultranationalists and adventurers from Russia, but also a genuine protest movement from people, Russian speakers in the Donbass, who were genuinely worried and alienated by what's happening in Kyiv. But anyway, a little bit of a detour there. Lugansk, one of the sort of two centres, in this case the centre for the former Lugansk People's Republic, and, you know, a city that has from time to time come under fire and shelling and bombing and such like. And he talks about this city that, on the one hand, he says has developed so well. In one phrase, under Ukraine, there were no roads, no decent wages, no law. Now, there are roads and there is law. Presumably, didn't he want to mention the wages? Anyway, so fine. So on the one hand, he's saying, oh, how much it's developed, thanks to being now connected with Russia and so forth. But he also talks about the fact that, yes, there's, you know, a lot of people still having a hard time, that there is an 11 p.m. curfew, that everything shuts by 9 p.m, which is pretty amazing for a Russian city, that there is no mobile internet for security reasons and such like. So, you know, he talks about actually all these wartime expedients, and yet, how is this article labelled? It is as an ordinary Russian city. He's trying to present Lugansk as an ordinary Russian city. Now, were I going to be particularly snarky, I would suggest that, you know, Isimura is suggesting that every Russian city will be a wartime state with a curfew and so forth. No, clearly not. He's trying to find some way of basically saying Russianness survives even in times of war. And that Russians have to accept that because, and this is the final, I think, component of the political ask, political offer, because essentially Russia is the scapegoat nation, that the world mistreats Russia, that the world essentially, and say the world, no, the West, I mean, essentially fails to acknowledge Russia's strengths, fails to acknowledge Russia's historical role. You know, we're back to the whole saving the world in World War II and so forth, or indeed basically saving the world from Napoleon, the French Antichrist. I haven't yet looked to see how the Russian press has been receiving Ridley Scott's latest Napoleon film. But the interesting thing is, as I understand it, I haven't seen the film, not sure if I will, but the Russian Tsar comes across actually, you know, more positively than he might as this sort of, you know, essentially engineer of Napoleon's downfall. If so, I imagine, frankly, Moscow's going to rather like that. But the fundamental point is this, that Russia is a country which is being uniquely and specially singled out, precisely because in some ways it holds up an unflattering mirror to the West. And this is how we can loop this back to the whole social conservatism, that the West ultimately realizes that it's lost its way. And that actually Russia is the one that is sort of true to the sort of values which matter. Remember, Russia regards itself as a European country. And so within the sort of the European slash Western cultural firmament. So because of that, because in some ways Russia makes us in the West feel bad, feel embarrassed, feel ashamed of what we've done, we strike back. It's interesting that at the end of November, Putin was speaking at this big AI summit, AI Journey 23, about the impact of artificial intelligence. And he made a big thing about the degree to which nasty, prejudiced Western artificial intelligence was in effect being used to try and cancel Russia. And, the search engines were not even throwing up examples of Russian culture and Russian history and Russian victories and so forth. So the idea that even in the digital space, Russia is being cancelled. So to try and sort of link all this together and give a sense of what I think is going on. First of all, Putin does care about politics. He does care about how he sells himself, his mission and his state to his people, for intensely practical reasons. The elections, as I say, are going to be the culmination of a process. So this is something we are going to see much, much more evident over the coming months. And that's why I think it's interesting that it's the 17th of December, we've got Putin's traditional annual press conference and his direct line sort of telephone marathon with his people actually smooshed together. And in part, I think that is, well, in part, I think it's because he's sick and tired of these particular rituals. But also, it's precisely to give some more coherent messaging to the Russian people. So this is something that we're going to be watching. And very much central to it is about Russia as a war-fighting state rather than Russia, a country fighting a war. In other words, again, it's all about this business of pulling together. And crucial to that is basically about making Russians feel good in times that, frankly, do not make them feel so good. So I think what we're going to see is a campaign built not so much around the old duality of guns versus butter. At the moment, clearly, Putin is still trying, though his budget will not allow it forever, but still trying to provide both. Nor is it the classic bread and circuses. Instead, I think the duality we need to be thinking about is pride versus success. In other words, at the moment, the war is not being won on the battlefield, though clearly there are hopes for the future. But in some ways, that doesn't matter because we can feel pride about the fact that we are still in the game, we are still fighting. And in that context, that Russia has always won through adversity. So in some ways, the adversity is necessary for the subsequent win. It's quite interesting, for example, that actually we're even beginning to see a partial restoration of the reputation of the Bolsheviks, who, Lenin particularly being regarded as the grand villain who planted a bomb under the Soviet Union because of his nationalities policies. But that sense that regardless of what you might think of their ideology, the fact of the matter is that the Bolsheviks still suffered through and yet were ultimately triumphant in the course of not just the sort of tail end of World War I, but then the subsequent Civil War. And through that, Bolshevik Russia became a power in the world, even if it was a world that turned round and despised this upstart Bolshevik nation. Again, this is the really interesting irony here. Putin, who clearly so despises that kind of Bolshevism, that frankly very ideological and even idealistic type of Bolshevism, nonetheless is increasingly accepting the parallels. Because Bolshevik Russia was despised by all, it was a pariah state, it was different from the mainstream. The capitalist nations even actually tried to topple Bolshevism with the interventions during the Russian Civil War, for everyone from the Americans and the Japanese to the Brits and the French and the Germans. But still, they survived and they thrived. So this is, I know it sort of spins out rather dramatically far from the initial question of, you know, whether or not more than one gay nightclub in Moscow was raided by the police. But I think this is the thing. We have to acknowledge that we're now going to be entering an era of increasingly performative politics. So, you know, when we look at what happens, don't necessarily take it at face value, but instead think, well, what is the message that is being conveyed? It's one in which I think precisely we're going to see a message that focuses not so much on the facts of war, but on the fact that a beleaguered Russia needs to have some kind of central identity to which everyone must cleave. And that, by definition, is going to mean there are some people excluded. Almost that's part of the point. I mean, what's the point in having an identity if you also don't have outsiders, others, to look down on or to persecute? It's one in which actually I think we're going to be seeing more and more attempts to try and square the circle. Oh, I'm using that metaphor too often at the moment. Anyway, to try and balance, on the one hand, the needs of expressing this as a crucial existential moment for Russians, with at the same time saying, but life goes on and life is actually pretty fine. And yes, maybe you can't get a new iPhone. But apart from that, you're living in a normal city, in a normal country, and don't get too overwhelmed by the events. And if you do find events overwhelming, well, shut the hell up. Learn that indifference of, you go back to Denis Volkov's phrase. Appreciate that there is nothing you can do that is negative. We want to encourage voluntarism when it's in support of the national idea and the national vision. And if you're not there, well, we're not necessarily going to come after you. I mean, there is no sign, for example, that we're actually going to see some kind of wider pogrom against the LGBT community. It's one thing to raid a few nightclubs just for one or more nightclubs just for a highly visual statement that actually, we do mean business. But really, the message that is being sent is, look, you want to be gay, you can be gay, but just do it out of sight. Do it quietly and discreetly. And I should say that I'm not actually kind of advocating that as a message, but I'm just simply saying that is different. That is more or less saying, we will not necessarily try and police how you think, how you feel. We'll police how you act and how you seem. So if you can't support the nation, if you can't support Putin, if you can't support this grand national journey on which we're on, just go home. Grumble around the kitchen table if you want. That's fine. But this is, after all, a very Soviet approach. And in so many ways, the more that Putin tries to sort of build a post-Soviet and non-Soviet national identity, the more he demonstrates the extent to which he is himself still very much Homo Sovieticus. Again, not a particularly uplifting note on which to end, except to say that I think very much he is a creature of his generation, and his generation will ultimately go. But nonetheless, there I shall end. Thank you. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.